content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Brandy Spragata for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Oprah Magazine. Our first article by Lane Dalfin is titled, If You've Ever Dreamt About a Friend in Trouble, That Might Have a Surprising Meaning. Dear Dream Analyst, I dreamed that I was standing on land as a good friend of mine was on a boat that kept flipping over. She always managed to get it to resurface and stay afloat, but whenever I turned around thinking she was fine, the boat would flip and pull her under again. When I went to try and help, it was all okay again. This kept happening over and over. Signed, Staying Afloat. Dear Staying Afloat, some dreams grab a listener like me through symbols, repetition, or a pun. In this dream, however, it's the role the dreamer is playing that has my attention. Typically, a dreamer assumes the role in the dream that they most identify with and places themselves within the action. But in this case, you're playing the part of the observer. This leads me to wonder if your dream is about a waking life situation that you're witnessing as opposed to being directly involved in. From a literal viewpoint, you're watching a good friend from afar while they're experiencing many ups and downs. One minute she's up, and as you say, the minute you turn around, the friend is down once more. I especially like your twist at the end where you say, when I went to try and help, it was all okay again. This plot reminds me of that sage advice to be careful in supporting a friend or family member in their difficulties with a significant other. It's a slippery slope, because sympathy can easily slide into taking sides and making negative comments about a friend's partner. While this kind of support can seem helpful, most situations between a couple tend to work themselves out. When their romance is afloat again, your words now hang out in the open. Our instinctive urge to console and protect a wounded friend or family member, perhaps even criticizing their partner, can leave the person you were trying to support feeling insulted or alienated from you. Also, keep in mind that the person this dream is actually about may not be the same friend who appears on the boat. To see if the waking life situation concerns a different person entirely, ask yourself if your feelings or memories related to your dream friend remind you of a particular real-life scenario. Perhaps the friend's voice reminds you of someone else. How would you describe this friend to someone who doesn't know her? Do you know anyone else with similar characteristics or qualities? Or try asking yourself if you know someone who is in a similar situation, metaphorically, to the one in the dream. This dream may reflect thoughts about a troubled or moody person in your life. Do you know someone who is always at the mercy of life's tides? If you spend time with someone until they're safe again, does this dream remind you that the minute you turn your back, the mood swings continue? Here's another way this dream resonates for me. Are you a parent? At first, you're simply watching. Then you're about to act, but immediately you see that your help isn't required. If this were my dream, it could be reflecting my indecision about stepping in to help one of my kids. Is the message of your dream that your child can stay afloat on their own? This dream underlines our powerlessness to change another person or their situation. There is some solace in this lesson because we're ultimately absolved of any responsibility in the outcome. Freedom comes for those who keep this in mind and remain an observer as opposed to a meddler. Remember, too, that your friend stays above the water. Your dream urges you to let your friend or family member take on their own problems. Finally, let's consider one more possibility. Since most dream theorists agree that all parts of a dream represent parts of the dreamer, this may be a case of you observing yourself. Might this dream be a picture of your own fluctuations on a certain subject or relationship? You may be noticing that your own ups and downs are more frequent than usual. Perhaps your dream is calling you to get involved and help yourself, as opposed to turning your back to walk away. In this scenario, take the step of walking towards a friend, family member, or counselor. Our dream's goal is always to move each of us from our interior conversation toward a daytime one. Our next article by Jashunda Sanders is titled, A New Book Reckons with the 100-Year Legacy of the Tulsa Race Massacre. This year commemorates the 100th anniversary of one of the deadliest acts of racial violence in America, the Tulsa Race Massacre. And in his latest book, The Groundbreaking, An American City and Its Search for Justice, historian Scott Ellsworth, a Tulsa native who served on the 1997 commission that recommended reparations for the survivors of the massacre, explains just how close we came to never knowing it happened. In the late spring of 1921, a black 19-year-old named Dick Rowland was arrested on the presumption that he raped a white 17-year-old girl, Sarah Page. As with many accusations made against black men at the time, the truth was less important to the town's lynch mob than was its thirst for racist vengeance. A horde of angry whites stormed the Greenwood District, also known as Black Wall Street, over the course of 16 hours between May 31, 1921, and throughout the day on June 1. Hundreds of mostly black Tulsans were killed and many more injured in the massacre, and some 1,000 homes were torched and looted. Many of Greenwood's thriving establishments, churches, schools, and businesses, were burned to the ground. Published to coincide with the centennial of the massacre, The Groundbreaking is but one of the important current accounts to shine a light on this significant historical event. Fans of popular culture were exposed to a brief but central reenactment of the tragedy for the 2019 Emmy Award-winning HBO limited series Watchmen, adapted from the graphic novel of the same name. Also premiering May 31st on PBS was Tulsa, The Fire and the Forgotten, a documentary on how the community of Tulsa is coming to terms with its past, present, and future. And on CBS, Tulsa 1921, An American Tragedy. On June 1st, OWN aired The Legacy of Black Wall Street. These commemorations have an added urgency today, not only because our country continues to grapple with entrenched anti-black sentiment and violence, but also because, as we learned from Tulsa transplant and teacher Nancy Feldman early on in The Groundbreaking, none of her native Oklahoman students grew up learning about the massacre. It had been erased from the collective memory. It was as if it had never happened at all, she is quoted as saying in the book. The Groundbreaking documents Ellsworth's dogged pursuit to excavate the details of what occurred on those days 100 years ago, since facts about what transpired were intentionally suppressed for decades. Op-eds and newspaper accounts from the time went missing. Entire police files, reports, and photographs were suppressed or eradicated. It seemed the entire city of Tulsa was in denial for many years subsequently, silently living with a long-buried truth. When Ellsworth asked white or even black residents to tell him what happened, many declined to speak. Ellsworth attributes this to a collective reluctance to acknowledge or relive what happened, and concludes that the survivors remain traumatized by the incidents even today. When Don Ross, a columnist for the city's black newspaper, the Oklahoma Eagle, wrote about the massacre, he pointed out that Tulsans have been trained generally to sacrifice truth and realism, to suppress their history for the sake of keeping superficial harmony in race relations. He may as well have been writing about American racism as a whole, which, like the Tulsa Massacre, continues to be met with appeasement, denial, and suppression. But as Ellsworth reminds us, when we can dig up truths and find the courage to face them, a kind of liberation feels possible. The Groundbreaking begins in a cinematic, true crime fashion, with Ellsworth's belief, based on rumors and stories in the town which have spread like folklore, that there are mass graves from the Tulsa Massacre that have yet to be identified. He also uncovers a police file of crucial evidence that had been concealed. By weaving in his personal history and conversations with Tulsa survivors and other natives, Ellsworth combines his gift for storytelling with a historian's dogged persistence to not only track the latest information on the existence and locations of those mass graves, but to offer essential insights as to why the Tulsa race massacres are emblematic of why American racial inequality persists and how we need to reckon with it so we can begin to seek true reconciliation. It was beginning 25 years ago, around the 75th anniversary of the events, that the truth about Tulsa finally began to surface. Ellsworth writes that between 1997 and 2002, 11 books were published about the riot, ranging from novels like Jewel Parker Rhodes' Magic City and Rila Askew's Fire in Beulah, to historical and journalistic accounts like Hannibal Johnson's Black Wall Street, Tim Madigan's The Burning, and James Hirsch's Riot and Remembrance. As of early 2021, he observes, readers could purchase nearly 24 books about Greenwood and the race massacre. There was no question that Greenwood and the massacre were working their way into the country's historical memory book. Ellsworth, whose previous book on the massacre, published in 1982, was entitled Death in a Promised Land, with his latest masterful work of history, illuminates the hard, never-finished work of unlearning racism and nurturing truth. He also prompts us to question how many other American stories and voices remain buried, waiting for dedicated historians with Ellsworth's persistence and passion to uncover them. Our next article by Samantha Vincenti is titled, 48 Hours correspondent Aaron Moriarty has been covering true crime for 30 years. Aaron Moriarty's average day involves talking to convicted killers, victims' families, lawyers, and law enforcement. She's reported from the war in Iraq and once gave a notorious serial killer her home address for a story. More on that later. As a true crime journalist, Moriarty has devoted her unwavering curiosity to probing cold cases and re-examining murder convictions on 48 Hours since 1990. So it may surprise you to learn that she never planned to be on TV in the first place. All I ever wanted to do was be a litigator, the 9-time Emmy Award winner tells OprahMag.com. That was my plan, and staying in Ohio. Moriarty's path to becoming the veteran journalist she is today did begin back in Ohio, where she was born and raised. After earning a degree in behavioral sciences and a subsequent law degree at Ohio State University, Moriarty practiced law for 2 years, but it didn't take long for her to notice the glass ceiling looming over her career. I was the only woman in the law firm, and the only way you were ever going to make money was by rainmaking, getting clients, she says. It's the Midwest. It's the late 70s, early 80s. Even the clubs where the lawyers would take their clients, women weren't allowed to join. I would have had to go with a guy. So she got creative. It occurred to Moriarty that TV appearances would be one way to get her name out to prospective clients in Columbus, and soon learned that a now-defunct broadcasting company was planning a new syndicated program to hit test markets in cities including her own. They thought it was so weird that a young female lawyer auditioned that they actually gave me the job. The gig turned out to be a match for Moriarty's skill set in ways she hadn't imagined. It was perfect. I could cover legal issues, she says. And as time went on, I realized I could even change the system, or at least inform people about the system, better from the outside than the inside. She admits that her novelty actually became an asset in the early 1980s. Now, you'll see all these female lawyers on Fox, but at that time, I stood out a bit. Getting the assignment she wanted was far harder, though, which is how she learned to become, to use a phrase Moriarty invoked several times in our conversation, a wall of sound. When I first started, I was general assignment, and they would assign me to the quote-unquote female topics when I wanted to cover legal and consumer issues. Moriarty's persistence in fighting for more investigative stories she believed in wasn't always well received, but it did prove effective. I would become a wall of sound and be such a pain in the butt that it was just easier to let me do the stories I wanted to do than hear me. Over the next few years, Moriarty took reporting jobs at TV stations in Baltimore, Cleveland, and Chicago. Then she set her laser-like focus on getting a job at CBS News. In a classic case of if you see it, you can be it, she already knew the network could put more women in front of the camera than ABC or NBC did, including now broadcast legends Leslie Stahl, Connie Chung, and Diane Sawyer. Moriarty joined CBS News in 1986 and started at 48 Hours 2 years later. America's seemingly bottomless appetite for true crime showed no signs of flagging in 2019, and the widespread fervor has been at its strongest for 5 years now. At the dawn of an era that's produced more media than any one person could consume in a lifetime, 2014 to 2015, respectively, Serial Season 1 and Netflix Making a Murderer both managed to grab a wide cross-section of fans who would dissect the case's tiniest details around office water coolers and via social media and Reddit threads. True crime podcasts further widen the parameters of whose stories get told and the many ways people can tell them. iTunes weekly podcast charts reflect a varied taste for all manner of macabre storytelling these days, from the slickly produced Dirty John to chattier formats that essentially recap reported articles they read. But long before all of that, series like 48 Hours, a pillar of the genre affectionately dubbed murder shows by its largely female fandom, set the conventions of true crime entertainment so future creators could experiment. Moriarty says one of her favorite things about being a 48 Hours correspondent is the time and resources she's given to get the best story, increasingly rare in a shifting news landscape that's become more about tight budgets and quick turnaround. One topic she's passionate about drawing attention to, wrongful convictions. "We're realizing there's so many reasons why people are wrongfully convicted," Moriarty says. "Even though I can't focus entirely on those stories, I'm allowed to stay on them, and they take years sometimes. The same warm curiosity that's evident when she interviews subjects on the show seems to drive Moriarty through the months of legwork alongside her producers. Why do people get convicted for something they didn't do? Why do people confess to things they didn't do? And that's one of the biggest reasons why I've stayed at 48 Hours, because I have the perfect job." Moriarty is particularly proud of her show's impact on the exoneration of Ryan Ferguson, whose 40-year sentence for the murder of Missouri sports writer Kent Hytholt was vacated in 2013. Though the 20-year-old Ferguson didn't know Hytholt and there was no physical evidence, his friend Charles Erickson told police they'd committed the crime after he dreamed they'd done it. Erickson has since recanted that confession. Moriarty first covered Ferguson's trial and his 2005 conviction shocked her. "So we stayed on the story," she says. 48 Hours was the first national outlet to follow the case, and they kept in touch with Ferguson's family and his legal team over 7 years. "We did 5 reports, and every time new evidence would come out. A new lawyer got involved and really took the case, and 10 years later we were there when he walked out. I almost know, almost certainly, that if you had not covered the trial, a lot of the facts would still remain probably hidden," Ferguson told Moriarty in a 2013 48 Hours interview. The scariest place Moriarty's work has taken her? A room with Dennis Rader, a.k.a. the BTK killer, whose story is told in Season 1 and 2 of Netflix's Mindhunter, for an interview that was never recorded. He didn't cry at all when we talked about how he tortured these women, but he cried because his daughter wasn't speaking to him, she remembers. In pursuing a possible segment, Moriarty wanted to use some of Rader's original artwork, but he would only give it to me if I gave him my home address, and I did, she says, a choice that understandably horrified her son. "At the time, I told him, 'Honey, he's never getting out.' And my son said, 'But how do you not know he's going to give our address to someone else?' Which was a very good point. Not one of my better moments," she laughs. In June 2019, Moriarty, who's reported for CBS News on everything from the death of Princess Diana to the 1995 Oklahoma City bombings to the mass shooting in Newtown, Connecticut, received a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Alliance for Women in Media Foundation. My colleagues were all joking with me, like, "Don't worry, Erin, we know you're not done." And when I picked a dress, I tried to pick a dress that said I'm not done. Her latest chapter, a foray into the podcast game herself. "My Life of Crime," released weekly, is a more personal and less formal look at the true crime story she's worked on. Moriarty is the first to acknowledge that the media landscape is vastly different in 2021 than it was when she started out in a 4 News network world. "You have to really want it today because it's tougher," she says. "On the other hand, there are far more opportunities. Networking is more important than ever. She can't recommend seeking out a mentor enough. And you have to be a good writer. To me, one of the most important skills you have is the ability to write quickly, clearly, and visually. But passion's probably the most important thing." She warns against getting into TV reporting for the glory, as that'll inevitably disappoint. Always enjoy where you are at that moment, because you can't always be in a hurry for the future, she adds. You really have to enjoy where you are at the time. Our next article by Samantha Vincenti is titled, What is Socialism? And how is it different than democratic socialism? The 2020 presidential race introduced the term democratic socialist to people who may never have heard it before the democratic debates. But what does it mean to be a democratic socialist? Let's break it down. Since the term is often misunderstood, it's simplest to start with what democratic socialism isn't. It is not a political party. It's also not completely interchangeable with the beliefs and practices of socialism. According to Mark A. Peterson, a professor of public policy, political science, and law at UCLA, democratic socialism is a call for the democratically elected to use the public sector to promote greater equality and opportunity. Those who identify as democratic socialists believe in giving everyone the chance to find equal economic footing and see free or low-cost health care, tuition-free public education, and universal child care as means to that end. Democratic socialists believe that both the economy and society should be run democratically, to meet public needs, not to make profits for a few, the Democratic Socialists of America, or DSA, website states. The DSA stands for restructuring our government and the U.S. economy so that ordinary Americans can participate in the many decisions that affect our lives. Holding major institutions, such as banks and corporations, accountable for decisions and actions that impact us is a major theme, and so is granting workers more of a voice in executive decision-making processes. This can take the form of workers' councils or more spots for employees on a corporation's board of directors. So what's the difference between a democratic socialist and a socialist? Merriam-Webster principally defines socialism as any of various economic and political theories of advocating collective or governmental ownership and administration of the means of production and distribution of goods. In short, that means that in a fully socialist country, the workers, be it in a factory, a corporation, etc., all hold a share of ownership of whatever is being produced. This can mean that workers literally own shares of their company, or maybe they're members of a board, sharing an equal say in decisions that affect every employee. In the ideal socialist scenario, all decisions are made for the good of all, with the members of society holding equal access to that nation's resources and social services. Collective and cooperative are popular buzzwords within socialist circles for this reason. It's a get-what-you-give scenario in which everyone believes that what you receive is in direct relationship to what you've put in labor-wise. However, in some countries, what seemed like a good idea on paper has ultimately led to tumult and power struggles when government leaders abuse the economic structure to benefit themselves instead of obeying the will of the people. Fervent believers in the virtues of capitalism also believe the lack of monetary rewards in a socialist country demotivates the worker, leading to a more lethargic economy. Socialism's second dictionary definition, a system of society or group living in which there is no private property, is what alarms the segment of Americans who fear it means their hard-earned money and resources could be repossessed by the state. However, Peterson maintains that socialism has nothing to do with anything that's being discussed in current American politics. Socialism, as it's been practiced in countries like Cuba and Vietnam, differs from the concept of democratic socialism. What the two belief systems do share is a central belief that the government should pay for, or at least help to pay for, what they see as basic rights for any citizen, healthcare, child care, and education in particular. Why is democratic socialism so controversial? It's the word socialist again, mostly, and the historical baggage that comes with it. The term socialism is frightening to many people in the U.S. because for decades it was associated with the USSR, or Union of Soviet Socialist Republics, says Peterson. That was dictionary socialism, actually communism, with the state assuming all powers. totalitarianism over the public. This has nothing to do with social insurance, social democracy, or democratic socialism. Conservative critics of democratic socialism in the media tend to create false equivalencies between it and the brand of socialism Peterson refers to, either out of misunderstanding or an effort to leverage lingering fears in older voters who may remember the Cold War between the U.S. and the USSR in the 1940s and 50s. What's also interesting is the extent to which the younger generations, who weren't around during the Cold War, don't have the same fears of the term, Peterson says. He's likely right. According to a 2019 Gallup poll, 43% of Americans said socialism would be a good thing for the country, an 18% increase from 1942. Another survey of 2,775 adults found that 61% of people age 18 to 24 preferred the word socialism to capitalism. Democratic socialism wasn't mentioned in either poll. So when millennials talk about concepts like democratic socialism, we're not talking about these kinds of Red Scare boogeymen, Ocasio-Cortez told Business Insider, referring to the finger-pointing crusade that occurred during the Cold War. We're talking about countries and systems that already exist that have already been proven to be successful in the modern world. Critics of democratic socialism, and particularly a government-funded healthcare plan that would cover every citizen at low or no cost, as opposed to the current system of private pay-out-of-pocket plans, say that it would be too pricey and lead to less competition in the healthcare market, and higher prices all around. They also claim Americans wouldn't stand for the higher tax rate likely required to pay for insurance. The number of uninsured Americans hit 13.7% at the end of 2018, its highest level in 4 years. Moving toward a system closer to that of Nordic countries, more on that below, would certainly require a perspective shift on the part of many U.S. taxpayers. But Peterson argues that many of the social benefits Americans have relied on for decades are already based in the ideas democratic socialists are fighting for. U.S. Medicare is social insurance, as is Social Security. Public education in the U.S. is financed by taxes that all pay in one form or another and is available to everyone for free, he says. Heck, so is protection from the fire department. Those who charge the Democrats with being socialist should, if they're honest, be actively campaigning to terminate all of these forms of publicly financed services. Is democratic socialism the same thing as social democracy? Not quite, though democratic socialism's most prominent advocates point to the latter's success in other countries as proof that it could work in the U.S. Social democracy is typically associated with robust, tax-financed welfare states that provide a range of inclusive government programs to promote greater equality and opportunity, Peterson explains. Those programs, he says, include universal health care, free or more financially attainable education, child care, job training, and pensions. But let's rewind, because it's important to unpack another word that makes some Americans nervous, the welfare in welfare states. Note that welfare here means general social welfare in which all are included, not the public assistance for the poor that's associated with the word welfare in the U.S., says Peterson. Some social democracies pay for public health care and other programs with what's called social insurance. Social insurance is, in some cases, tax-financed, meaning citizens in those countries may pay a tax rate Americans would consider high. But the counterargument is that they're not paying out of pocket for private insurance and education. Other countries, like Germany, chiefly finance their public welfare programs through payroll contributions. Both Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and Bernie Sanders have urged voters to consider the welfare state systems that have long existed in other capitalist countries as an example of something that could benefit Americans. I think we should look to countries like Denmark, Sweden, and Norway and learn from what they have accomplished for their working people, Sanders said in the 2016 Democratic debates. When discussing her own ideas for health care for all, Ocasio-Cortez told Business Insider, "We're talking about single-payer health care that has already been successful in many different models, from Finland to Canada to the UK. How does democratic socialism fit into capitalism? Well, one certainly doesn't cancel out the other. Many of the social democracies that Sanders and Ocasio-Cortez cite as inspiration for their economic plans, Sweden and Finland, for example, are thriving capitalist countries. These are decidedly capitalist economies with private ownership of property, private corporations, and fairly large numbers of wealthy entrepreneurs and families, Peterson points out. Sanders did identify as socialist, as opposed to a democratic socialist, way back when he was mayor of Burlington in the 1980s. But even then, that role required him to help the Vermont city thrive economically, ultimately ushering in the revitalization of downtown Burlington. I wouldn't say we got along with the business community, but if you check my record of my 8 years as mayor of Burlington, the entire city did quite well, Sanders told the Pod Save America podcast in July 2019. Ocasio-Cortez told MSNBC's Chuck Todd that she thinks it's possible for someone to be both capitalist and a democratic socialist, while allowing that not every democratic socialist may feel that way. It's not about government takeover. It's about how much do workers have a say in your business. What countries are democratic socialist? None. The DSA's site is quick to point out that other countries have reaped the benefits of socialist parties and labor movements' work, writing that we can learn from the comprehensive welfare state maintained by the Swedes, from Canada's national healthcare system, France's nationwide child care program, and Nicaragua's literacy programs. While those countries employ ideals espoused in democratic socialism and have active socialist parties, Nicaragua is the only one with a socialist governing party. Our next article by Michelle Darasaw is titled The True Story Behind Green Book. Director Peter Farrelly's 2018 period dramedy recounts a real-life road trip through the Deep South during the turbulent 1960s and Jim Crow era. The passengers of Farrelly's theatrical vehicle are acclaimed pianist Dr. Don Shirley and Frank Anthony Vallelonga, who is affectionately referred to as Tony Lip for his gift of gab. The audience is asked to ride shotgun while watching this odd couple in a turquoise Cadillac sedan DeVille deal with racism and segregation. Green Book is reminiscent of the classic 1989 movie Driving Miss Daisy, starring Morgan Freeman and Jessica Tandy. Only this time, a white man is behind the wheel, Vallelonga, and a black man is giving directions from the back seat, Dr. Shirley. The two men couldn't be more different, both in their ethnic makeup and in their beliefs. Yet through the redemptive power of music, they form an unexpected friendship in the midst of racism and segregation. This joyride and tour of the South is all at once entertaining, uncomfortable, and most importantly, necessary, prompting praise from filmgoers for its realistic depiction of the racial unrest of the 60s. However, Green Book was not without its criticism. Dr. Shirley's family has referred to the film as a symphony of lies, admonishing Farrelly for whitewashing Dr. Shirley's legacy and not consulting them about the script. Not to mention, some critics panned the movie as racially tone-deaf and accused Farrelly and scriptwriters of perpetuating a white savior stereotype, a term used to describe a cinematic device commonly used in film to depict a white character rescuing people of color from a difficult situation. I feel bad about that. I wish we could have done more, Farrelly admitted to Newsweek about not reaching out to Dr. Shirley's surviving family members. To be honest, the people looking into it just didn't find them. They screwed up. I'm sure there will be some criticism that the film is not authentic because it's not dark enough, but that's not my style. We didn't want to preach to the choir. The notion of Green Book surrounded in a cacophony of controversy is valid, and partly the reason why some are wondering whether there's any truth to the story. For example, did Dr. Shirley really hire Vallelonga as his driver? Was Vallelonga actually as racist as he appears in the film? Did the pair remain friends after their road trip? All reasonable questions. Fortunately, we have the answers to those questions and more thanks to statements from Dr. Shirley's living family members and Vallelonga's son, Nick Vallelonga, who is also one of the co-writers for the movie. I wanted the feelings to come from the truth because the story is so amazing that the truth is enough, Vallelonga's son told Time. I felt that we could not make up a scene in this movie. Read on to discover how the story of two guys in the car and their relationship became one of 2018's most talked about movies. Here's why Dr. Shirley hired Vallelonga to be his driver and bodyguard. As audiences saw in the film, Vallelonga was a bouncer at the Copacabana nightclub in New York City. Dr. Shirley, a musical prodigy born in Pensacola, Florida, actually started playing the piano at the age of 2. Before preparing for his very own concert tour in 1962, Dr. Shirley, like many music fans of that time, was privy to the violence and racial slurs inflicted upon other black musicians when they went to the South to perform. One of those legendary artists was Nat King Cole, who was famously beaten on stage by the Ku Klux Klan of the Confederacy in 1956 in Birmingham, Alabama, just 6 years before Dr. Shirley would make his trek to the state. As a result, Dr. Shirley hired the Bronx-born Vallelonga to be his chauffeur and security while on tour. According to Time, Vallelonga's son heard the road trip stories firsthand from both his father and Dr. Shirley. He also kept the letters his father sent to his wife, Dolores Vallelonga, which serve as the film's source material. He maintained that he received his dad and Dr. Shirley's blessings before turning these tales and letters into a script, with just one stipulation from Dr. Shirley: to not publish anything until after his death. "You should put in everything your father told you and everything I told you," Vallelonga recalled Dr. Shirley saying. "You tell exactly the truth, but you're going to wait until I pass." The movie is based on an actual green book. From 1936 to 1966, Harlem postal worker Victor H. Green published a survivor's manual titled The Negro Motorist Green Book, an International Travel Guide, which explains where the film gets its name. Green compiled the book as a resource for black travelers to cope with discrimination in whites-only sundown towns, which is used to describe the cities that displayed racist signs cautioning African Americans to not travail after dusk in their towns. The book was also implemented to aid people of color in finding safe lodging, gas stations, and restaurants while journeying throughout the U.S., particularly in the South. The Green Book tried to provide a tool to deal with those situations. Lonnie Bunch, director of Smithsonian's National Museum of African American History and Culture, told the New York Times in August 2010. It also allowed families to protect their children, to help them ward off those horrible points at which they might be thrown out or not permitted to sit somewhere. It was both a defensive and a proactive mechanism. Vallelonga was racist in real life. In the first half of the film, Vallelonga is vilified to a certain degree in how he refers to black people and his refusal to drink behind a group of black servicemen in one particular scene. He also treats African Americans as a monolith, giving in to certain racial stereotypes, like the idea that all African Americans eat chicken and that they only listen to certain music. Near the end of the movie, the road trip changes Vallelonga's perspective, something that his son confirmed with Time. "My dad was a product of the times and his environment, and that's not an excuse for anything," Vallelonga said. "All that went away after he became friends with Dr. Shirley and after this crazy trip they took together and what happened to them. Now, it wasn't just something you heard about. He saw it. He witnessed it." Later in the Time interview, Vallelonga added, "This particular trip really, really affected him and changed him. It changed the way he brought us up, that everyone is equal and everyone is the same." Dr. Shirley and Vallelonga were friends in real life, but that depends on who you ask. After the heartwarming scene in which Dr. Shirley goes to the Vallelonga family's home for Christmas dinner, Green Book fans were left wondering if Dr. Shirley and Vallelonga remained friends. "Everything changed from that moment on," said Vallelonga's son, maintaining that their friendship grew deeper and that his father listened to Dr. Shirley. However, Dr. Shirley's family insisted that they weren't close at all. "It was an employer-employee relationship," Patricia Shirley, sister-in-law of Dr. Shirley, told Shadow and Act in an exclusive interview. She said that her brother-in-law preferred to keep things professional, and that was the only kind of relationship that Dr. Shirley ever had with any of the people he worked with. After the closing credits rolled in Green Book, Dr. Shirley went on to play Carnegie Hall in 1971. Both Vallelonga and Dr. Shirley died in 2013, within 5 months of each other. Here's the one thing that isn't true in the movie. The film isn't exactly a faithful retelling, as the road trip took place in a span of a year and a half. The movie depicts it lasting for 2 months. This is the only creative license Vallelonga's son Nick said the filmmakers took. Other than the amount of time they spent in the car together, he suggested the narrative is completely accurate from his recollection of events. I think that's why it resonates, because it's truthful, he said. Our next article by Adam Schubach and Megan Lasher is titled, Should Straight Actors Play LGBTQ Characters? In 2016, the hashtag #OscarsSoWhite began trending after the Academy of Motion Pictures Arts and Sciences received backlash for only celebrating films with white actors in lead roles. Since, Hollywood executives appear to have slowly taken notice, rolling out movies that are not only successful, but also embrace diversity. Black Panther and Crazy Rich Asians, for instance, feature two nearly all-black and all-Asian casts, and quickly became 2018 blockbusters. But despite progress made toward inclusivity, LGBTQ representation remains comparatively stagnant in film. According to GLAAD's 2018 Studio Responsibility Index, only 12.8% of movies in 2017 featured characters that identified under the LGBTQ umbrella. Which brings us to a hotly contested idea. Who's allowed to portray queer folk on camera anyway? This conversation resurfaced with the announcement of the 2019 Oscar nominees, which include Rami Malek for Bohemian Rhapsody, and Olivia Colman, Rachel Weisz, and Emma Stone, the actresses of The Favourite, all of whom portray LGBTQ characters despite not being, publicly at least, queer themselves. It's a question that's become the elephant in the room when queer plotlines are popularized. For decades, straight actors have received praise and Oscars for taking up LGBTQ roles that push stories about the AIDS crisis and what it means to struggle with identity. Tom Hanks in Philadelphia, Charlize Theron in Monster, Sean Penn in Milk, and both Heath Ledger and Jake Gyllenhaal in Brokeback Mountain, to name a few. Whether these historic roles should have gone to queer actors, however, is a touchy topic that the industry doesn't seem to know how to answer. Though award-winning films like Carol, starring Cate Blanchett and Rooney Mara, and Call Me By Your Name, starring Armie Hammer and Timothée Chalamet, two stories about same-sex love starring straight leads, received accolades from pioneering organizations like GLAAD, they're also subject to backlash from within the queer community. And at the 2019 Golden Globes, Darren Criss, a straight actor, took home the Best Actor Award for his portrayal of Andrew Cunanan, a gay man, in the assassination of Gianni Versace. He announced shortly after that he would only play non-queer parts, telling Bustle, "I want to make sure I won't be another straight boy taking a gay man's role." So when the time comes to cast actors to portray queer characters, what's the right thing to do? In one camp, many argue that vocal LGBTQ actors, Laverne Cox, Tracy Lissette, Jamie Clayton, MJ Rodriguez, should use their own queer experiences to tell specifically queer stories. Others, however, argue that allowing straight allies to tell queer stories only helps the LGBTQ community's visibility. For a clear understanding of both sides, we turn to two LGBTQ writers. Here they sound off. Megan Lasher, Senior Manager of Content Strategy at Hearst Digital Media, says, "Save queer roles for queer actors." The entire counter-argument to the idea of letting straight people portray gay characters can be summed up in three words. Queer actors exist. There are real, live, talented queer people who are not mythical or hiding away on Lesbos Island, but are in fact walking into audition rooms and getting turned down in favor of more famous or possibly more relatable actors. This alone should be enough reason to stop the long-running trend of allowing straight people to tell our stories. LGBTQ-themed movies and music that make a profit should put money back into the queer community, not into the hands of the straight people who have appropriated our identities. As Hollywood has proven time and time again, producers are willing to hire straight, cisgender, meaning someone who identifies with their birth sex, actors for just about any role. Meanwhile, LGBTQ actors are pigeonholed into auditioning for queer roles, which are then, you guessed it, given to straight, cis people. But beyond the obvious, another big reason why it's not okay for straight people to be in these roles is because it paints queerness as a costume, something you can choose to wear or not to wear. If you're a straight girl dressing up in flannel and Doc Martens and pulling on a short-haired wig, you're basically stereotyping me in order to be read as queer. It feels like a poke at my identity, and on top of that, an assumption that all lesbians dress a certain way. This debate came up recently when Fun Home, the musical based on lesbian cartoonist Alison Bechdel's graphic memoir, went on tour and brought on a straight actress, who was formerly Miss America, to play the grown-up Alison. Though Bechdel and the producers were okay with the changes to the role, a lot of audience members, myself included, took issue with the way Kate Schindel donned a lesbian identity. She cut her hair and wore flannel and jeans, suggesting that queerness is nothing more than a fashion choice and a haircut. Take this 10 steps further when a film has a trans or gender nonconforming character. To cast a cis man, meaning a male-identified person who was assigned male at birth, in a transgender woman's role is beyond offensive. Comparing trans identity to drag is dumbing down exactly how complex and unique these lived experiences are. At the end of the day, straight actors can take off all of their offensive garb and walk home to a life that is not at all impacted by homophobia, transphobia, or other LGBTQ issues. That is something queer people can never do. It's the idea that these actors can't fully understand the world from the queer lens that ultimately detracts from the art of whatever production a straight character is playing gay in. Art is meant to be reflective. If my friends and I want to relate to a story that takes on LGBTQ topics, why would we look to a straight person to tell it? Movies are meant to create empathy because they allow viewers to walk in someone else's shoes, so it makes no sense for a straight person to understand queer issues by just talking to another straight person. There's so much nuance, so much beauty, pain, and love that would slip through the cracks. We've already seen that it's possible for Hollywood to have successful shows with LGBTQ actors. Ryan Murphy's Pose, which fictionally explores New York City's 1980s ballroom culture the way the documentary Paris is Burning did, has become a hit television program in just one season. Its stars, many of whom have received large followings and major award nominations, are mostly queer people of color, which makes the show feel both more relatable and realistic. I'm not cranky all of the time, I promise. I've seen and enjoyed just about every film that has a gay plot or subplot that's come out in the last 50 or so years. We don't have that many to choose from, so it hasn't been very hard to watch them all. I adored The Favorite and love Simon. I understand the need to have star power results in Blake Lively portraying a bisexual woman in A Simple Favor. And I get that even with straight actors, these movies are still making great strides for our community. But I think that these productions walked so that future queer-focused, queer-starring movies can run. We will have no queer stars if our hit movies continue to feature straight, cis people. And with no shortage of talented LGBTQ actors, Sarah Paulson, Laverne Cox, Lena Waithe, Tessa Thompson, Hari Neff, Tommy Dorfman, to name only a few, there's no room for the argument that there's a lack of options. We've gotten to the point now where LGBTQ people are more visible than ever. Now it's time to demand that we see ourselves in our own stories. Adam Schubach, partnerships editor, says a person's sexual orientation shouldn't be part of the casting process. First and foremost, let me begin by saying that this is not an argument against inclusivity in Hollywood. There is a definite need for more diverse stories and voices to tell those stories, queer or otherwise. However, that issue is not solved by preventing straight people from taking on gay roles. That supports an us-versus-them mentality that only adds to the divisiveness that already runs rampant across the country. Let's try a different angle. Straight actors have been and should continue to be our allies in this quest for visibility and acceptance. Having a film like Moonlight take home the Oscar for Best Picture in 2017 was deeply impactful for the queer community, regardless of how many actual queer actors were in it. In fact, Mahershala Ali didn't even portray a queer character in that film, but when he got on stage to accept his Best Supporting Actor Oscar, he spoke about what he learned working on the project, and how we, as a culture, have a tendency to get caught up in the minutiae of what makes us all different. A cisgender straight black Muslim man preached a message of tolerance and acceptance on a stage in front of millions of viewers. We can't shun that kind of ally. There are so many cases of cisgender straight actors acknowledging their privilege but using their platform to speak out on issues that affect our community. And we can't forget that Moonlight won that award less than 2 years after the legalization of gay marriage in the U.S. Over 20 years earlier in 1994, Tom Hanks won the Best Actor Oscar for portraying a gay man living with HIV/AIDS in Philadelphia. And the social climate was much different then. It was the first mainstream Hollywood movie to address the issue, and Hanks ended his speech by tearfully acknowledging victims of the crisis. The movie made over $206 million around the world, largely due to the combined star power of Tom Hanks and co-stars Denzel Washington and Antonio Banderas. This was a lot of attention suddenly paid to a crisis that people had turned a blind eye to less than a decade earlier. These actors learn about our experiences by being in these films, and the same goes for the fans who watch them. Whether based on true stories or pure fiction, this type of visibility can't be written off simply because the actors in it identify as heterosexual. We also can't ignore television shows like Queer as Folk, The L Word, and Will and Grace. They help normalize the LGBTQ community to a world previously set in a presumptively heteronormative mindset. A person's queer identity, or lack thereof, shouldn't have a place in the casting process any more than it should factor into job hiring in other industries. Ultimately, deciding who the best person is for the job or the role should come down to talent and ability. The issue that occurs when straight actors take on gay roles is whether they rely on stereotypes to bring these characters to life. But by attempting to push the only LGBTQ actors should play queer characters agenda, you are essentially saying that all actors who want to be considered for these roles must prove their membership in the community. I personally find it infuriating watching press tours for LGBTQ-focused films where actors are grilled about their identities. When Lucas Hedges was promoting the severely underrecognized film Boy Erased, he told Vulture, "I recognize myself as existing on that spectrum, not totally straight, but also not gay and not necessarily bisexual." Hedges turned in an extremely moving portrayal of a young man going through gay conversion therapy. He also plays a very convincing drug addict in Ben Is Back. Why must that unlabeled fluidity play a factor in his Boy Erased role when there are no questions about whether he had an addictive personality in order to channel his character in Ben Is Back? Cate Blanchett also experienced a barrage of asinine questions about her experiences with same-sex relationships while promoting Carol. She addressed that situation while attending the 2018 Rome Film Festival, saying, "I will fight to the death for the right to suspend disbelief and play roles beyond my experience. Particularly in America, I think we expect and only expect people to make a profound connection to a character when it's close to their experience." She added, "Part of being an actor, to me, it's an anthropological exercise, so you get to examine a time frame, a set of experiences, an historical event that you didn't know anything about. Requiring actors playing gay parts to be out in some way to sell tickets will just open Pandora's box with an onslaught of unnecessary PR stunts. There is nothing stopping actors from being suggestive about their sexuality to qualify them to play a role. Instead, we should just accept the support from our cis-hetero allies." It's also worth noting that queerness means different things to different people. If we only require queer roles to be filled with queer actors, what will the barometer be? If an actor says they're open to same-sex encounters but never acts on those desires, do they get a pass? I definitely don't want to imagine who will decide whether someone is on the spectrum enough to be considered for these parts. And no two gay experiences are the same. A millennial gay actor, for instance, is as far removed from the gaze of the Stonewall era and the AIDS epidemic as a straight actor. Both will need to do their research. Simply falling under the LGBTQ umbrella is not enough criteria. The job of an actor is to get into the heads of their characters. The most talented actors are able to sell their performances unflinchingly. The idea that straight actors are wearing queerness as a costume, like Megan suggests, comes into play when the source material is lacking in some way. Take Ryan Murphy's Pose, for example. Like Megan pointed out, it's a show full of gay and trans characters played by gay and trans people. But then there's Psy heterosexual actor Evan Peters. His character is a straight married man who falls in love with a trans woman. Does that then make the character queer? Given that storyline and the counter-argument that these roles should only be played by LGBTQ people, does that mean the show should have casted the role differently? I don't think so. I love Pose, and it makes me incredibly proud that it exists on network television. We've come a long way from LGBTQ characters being reduced to what they're wearing or their inflection. These characters are finally being shown as three-dimensional people, and with that comes more nuanced performances by the actors who portray them. To me, it's a bit presumptuous to think that gay actors aren't also putting on a costume just because they share some of the same identity traits as the character they're playing. I'm a gay, Jewish, cisgender white guy. There are a lot of labels in that short sentence. If they were making a movie about my life, I can't say which of those labels should be requirements on the casting call. But I'd be slightly offended to learn that the only prerequisite to capturing my likeness is someone who is a fellow card-carrying homosexual. There's a lot more to me than any of those labels suggest, and I hope that whoever plays me, regardless of how they identify, would be able to capture that. And they better at least get an Oscar nomination for it. We have run out of time for today's episode of Oprah Magazine. I hope you enjoyed it, and be sure to listen next time. I'm Brandi Spragata, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Oprah Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.